More than 1,000 people marched in downtown Portland yesterday. It was one of several May Day events throughout Oregon. As Pete Springer reports, the causes in Portland and Salem ranged from peace to immigrant rights.
No peace, no work. No peace.
Dozens of longshore workers gathered by the Willamette River in Portland to demonstrate against the war in Iraq. The workers joined 25,000 longshoremen at 29 West Coast ports and taken the day off for the protest. This despite the fact that a federal arbitrator had ordered the union members to report to work. Jerry Lawrence is a self-described peon with the International Longshore and Warehouse Union in Portland. He's not worried about getting fired for not showing up for work.
If that's what they wish to do, then they got to fire 25,000 of us because we stand in solidarity.
Lawrence and other union members were joined by peace activists and military veterans against the war. They placed hundreds of carnations in the river to commemorate more than 4,000 U.S. soldiers who have died in Iraq. Bruce Holt with the union says the idea of protesting the war instead of going to work was to send a message to politicians in Washington. That message is that working people are the ones paying the price for the war.
You know, we've been against wars in the past, the Vietnam War and stuff, but it's about time this is precedence. We've never taken a day shift off or stopped work for a war. We've done it for meetings, you know, stop work meetings, but never for a war.
Holt says the war is too expensive and too deadly to support. He says the money spent on the war, about $500 billion so far, would have been better spent on education and health care in the U.S. Meanwhile, a different sort of labor protest was taking place in Salem. Gathered in front of the state capitol, thousands of people took up the cause of immigrant rights. 16-year-old Mia Fernandez was one of them.
I think that we should be legal, or at least they should give us license or something so we can work to support our family and all the Mexicans out here, because we pay taxes and we deserve to live here.
Many speakers urged the rollback of a new law that requires people to show proof of legal residence in the country in order to get a driver's license. They believe the new requirement is an attack on undocumented immigrants, many of whom are migrant workers on farms and nurseries throughout Oregon. Pete Springer, OPB News.
Ballots are being sent out today for Oregon's May 20th primary. The Oregon primary this year is going to have a national significance it hasn't had for 40 years. So as we head into the days when the voters become one with their voters' pamphlets and make their decisions, we're joined, as we are every week, by Bill Lunch, our political analyst from Corvallis. Hi, Bill.
Good morning, Casey.
Now, with ballots showing up in mailboxes, the primary election, it feels like it's really arrived, even if it concludes May 20th. What do we know from previous elections about how voters cast their ballots when they're using Oregon's very unique vote-by-mail system?
Well, right. We've been using vote-by-mail for about 8 years now, and patterns have emerged. Once ballots arrive, a certain number of voters quickly mark them and return them. Those early responders used to be a third of the total, sometimes even more. But now, more recently, fewer and fewer voters send their ballots back quickly. These days, elections officials don't expect to get more than 25%, perhaps only 20% of the ballots returned quickly within the first 3 to 4 days after they arrive. Then there's a substantial drop-off, and relatively few ballots arrived until until a few days before the election day. That's May 20th this time. And the last day to submit a ballot is that May 20th. In those last 3 to 4 days, we can expect a half, maybe even more than a half of the ballots that are going to be cast will come into the counties. These patterns are politically important because the candidates and their campaign managers realize that they have to conduct campaigns that stretch out over almost 3 weeks rather than focusing on one day. The vote-by-mail system resembles a marathon rather than a sprint. Dan Levy, who is a Republican campaign manager here in Oregon, once jocularly compared the campaigns under vote-by-mail to the movie Groundhog Day, in which the main character relives the same day over and over again.
And it's also known as one of Chris Elliott's finer performances. Now, registration for the primary closed on Tuesday. The Secretary of State reports that more than 2 million Oregonians are now registered to vote, and that includes thousands of new voters. But large numbers of former independents and even some former Republicans also re-registered as Democrats. The Democratic presidential primary is the focus of a lot of attention. Is that why we've seen the increased numbers of Democratic voters?
Well, it's certainly the key contest and the one generating the greatest amount of interest and attention. We've spoken in recent weeks about the renewed national prominence of the Oregon presidential primary. You mentioned it just a moment ago. For the first time since 1968, the Oregon primary really matters to candidates for president, and so it matters to voters. But the Democratic primary also includes interesting contests otherwise. For example, the Democratic primary for attorney general will almost certainly decide that office because there are no Republicans running. And the Democratic nominees for secretary of state and state treasurers will be strongly favored because the Republicans had a hard time recruiting even newcomers to run for those offices.
Now, switching to Republicans, there have been reports, including one by April Baer on this station, that Senator John McCain will be coming to Oregon in about 10 days to swing through the state prior to the conclusion of the primary.
Right.
He's got the Republican presidential nomination pretty much wrapped up. So is he coming for the scenery or vacation? Why is he making the trip?
He wants to do some spring skiing. No, probably not. McCain has the luxury of going wherever he likes, but there are at least two reasons for his visit here. First, while he has the delegates necessary to win the Republican presidential nomination, he has not yet fully consolidated his support among Republican voters. He's doing much better now than he was even a month ago. He won 73% of the vote in Pennsylvania, and that's an impressive number, but it means that something more than a quarter of Republican voters there voted against him. And for either Ron Paul or Mike Huckabee, only Ron Paul will be on the ballot here against McCain in the Oregon primary. But secondly, McCain is already able to begin paying attention to potential swing states in the general election in November, and his campaign managers believe that Oregon is likely to be one of those, so the forthcoming visit is also, at least in part, aimed at November.
And we shouldn't wrap up our talk today without noting that the president of the University of Oregon, Dave Frohnmayer, has announced that he will retire, but not immediately, not till June of 2009. Frohnmayer used to be a popular elected official, but in recent years he showed no interest in running for office again. Now, does he have a few more credits to take care of at the U, or are there other factors at work in his decision to delay his retirement?
Well, being a university president in the years since 1990, when the property tax limit, that's Measure 5, often known as that, was enacted, has been anything but fun. And so higher ed's been hit by a repeated set of budget cuts. So Frohnmayer's job in Eugene has not been easy. His political problem is that he's a moderate in a Republican Party that's moved a great deal to the right since he was a state legislator back in the 1970s. He was elected attorney general in 1980 as a moderate and reelected twice. But by 1990, when he ran for governor, religious conservatives ran a spoiler candidate to his right. That person drained off 13% of the vote. That threw the election to Barbara Roberts. Since that time, moderate Republicans have had a very difficult time winning nominations in their party, and some have simply left. So John Frohnmayer, Dave Frohnmayer's brother, is running for the Senate this year, but as an independent.
All right, Bill. That filled me in quite a bit.
Good.
Appreciate our chat, and we'll talk to you next week.
My pleasure.
All right. Bill Lunch is OPB's political analyst and the chair of the Political Science Department at Oregon State University. Nike's two founders were CEO Phil Knight and Bill Bowerman, the University of Oregon's legendary track and field coach. The fledgling company's third employee was Jeff Hollister. Now, as Christy George reports, Hollister has written Out of Nowhere, a loving but clear-eyed portrait of the little Oregon shoe company that's led the industry almost since it started, way back in 1964.
Jeff Hollister's mother told him, "Get a teaching certificate." She didn't think the shoe thing would work out. He didn't listen.
How you doing?
Good,
good. Who do I make this out to?
Betty.
Betty?
Last week, he signed hundreds of copies of Out of Nowhere at Nike's Beaverton headquarters. It's clear on every page that long before the first shoe was sold, Nike's culture, its psyche, was forged on the University of Oregon running track where the late Bill Bowerman presided.
He said, "You will have a far better chance in life being successful as a member of a team than you ever will as an individual."
Before anyone had ever heard of tough love, Bowerman was all about both love and tough. He was demanding and unconventional, always testing his so-called men of Oregon, even urinating on them.
If Bowerman lived today and performed a number of the teaching lessons as he did to us back in the 60s and, you know, with Phil's generation going back in the 50s, he'd get fired immediately. I mean, it just would not be tolerated today.
But Bowerman also fashioned weightless running shorts out of parachute material and pressed urethane shoe soles in his wife's waffle iron. He even concocted a homemade sports drink out of lukewarm tea, sugar, and salt.
We called it lamb's piss. But Bill, again, was ahead of his time.
One of Bowerman's runners came back from Stanford Business School with an idea for his old coach. His name was Phil Knight.
There are so many people that have fingerprints on the culture of Nike, but Bowerman is certainly one of them and maybe the most important. But Bowerman not only really coached and really believed in teamwork, but he also railed against what he thought was inappropriate authority. So there was a lot of rebel in Bill Bowerman, and I think some of that rubbed off on us.
He said, only one of you are going to win your event today. So what does that make the rest of you? Are you a loser? He said, third place will be 1 point, and that may make the difference between winning the dual meet as a team. And so your 1 point's very important. And I tended to be one of the 1 point guys, as was Phil Knight. We would never win, but we would pick up a point.
From the start, the little shoe company broke the rules. It was the mid-60s. The Grateful Dead, Ken Kesey, and the Merry Pranksters hung out in Eugene. While their competitors wooed athletes with bags of cash, Hollister writes, Nike people were runners. So Oregon running star Steve Prefontaine wore Nikes.
He had no idea that his life was going to end at 24, but he packed so much into it.
Hollister says Pre was the first and best critic of his shoes.
Bowerman always believed good products solve problems. And with Prefontaine, he would just come right out and tell you, I'm not going to wear this damn shoe until you get rid of that seam down the middle of the toe that's blooding my foot every time I run in it. And I always said, if we could satisfy him, we could satisfy just about anybody.
Hollister did everything from design shoes and clothes to sell shoes out the back of his car. And everywhere runners went, in Eugene, at the Boston Marathon, at Olympic trials, Hollister was there befriending them. Track and field stars like Mack Wilkins, Bruce Palmer, and Rudy Chapa.
If you're an athlete and you're pursuing excellence, you have a very clear list of priorities and a very strong focus on those priorities. And it helps to have an advocate.
And in those days, you know, to get a free pair of shoes, or if you're at a special event like the World Cross Country or something, to go to a dinner with all the other Nike athletes, that was something that Nike always did and sort of kept everybody connected.
The relationship was about wearing Nike. More than anything else, it was about his friendship. And the reason why he did so well in everything that he did for Nike is because he put his heart into it. And anyone he communicated with felt that. And there's nothing the guy could ever ask of me that I wouldn't do.
Eventually, the indie startup became so successful it grew up and got professional, formalizing the Swoosh logo and changing the company's name from the original Blue Ribbon Sports. Phil Knight wanted to name it after his favorite singing group at the time, The Fifth Dimension.
That was my thinking, was that this is now the sixth dimension, but it would have been hard to get that on the back tab of a shoe.
Hollister writes that Knight always gave people plenty of room to innovate and to make mistakes.
It's a risk-taking environment, and risk is failure. And if you're afraid to fail, you'll never try.
Nelson Ferris talked his way into a job and later out of being fired.
And around here, we taught ourselves to do the best we can, deal with failure, but come right back, which all comes from athletics. If you win, you're great. If you work hard, if you lose, you feel bad for one day and you get back to work and then you try to win again.
Nike kept winning, and soon John McEnroe, Lance Armstrong, and Tiger Woods wore the shoes. So did Mick Jagger and Elton John. In 1978, Nike's global sales hit $50 million. 4 years later, $500 million.
Something unique about Nike is that we sort of created our own rules.
Michael Jordan's red on black Nikes broke NBA rules. He just kept paying the fines and wearing the shoes. Eventually, the NBA changed its rules. Jeff Hollister writes about the goofs, too, like Nike's failure to see that women might want sneakers, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, we were kind of a bunch of male dummies there in the early days.
Being on the road so much for Nike cost Hollister his first marriage. And when offered a chance to invest in the company, he bought his first house instead.
My mistake.
Still, 33 years later, Hollister still loves Nike. And Phil Knight says the feeling is mutual.
I think the affection that the people inside this company have for Jeff Hollister is really almost limitless.
Hollister's colleague Kevin Brown worked with him for 30 years.
As long as this company is involved in track and field, there are three people responsible: Bowerman, Knight, and Jeff.
Really? Period. He credits Prefontaine.
Pre was an inspiration on the track. Jeff sold shoes.
If people say, well, I was the guy, I think it's only because I've lived longer and I've been able to stick around to tell the stories.
Christy George, OPB News.